This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. When J.J. Johnson was 15 years old, she voluntarily checked herself into an inpatient eating disorder unit. Although she was really struggling at the time, she had the sense that one day in the future, she would be a healthy and happy adult. And she made a promise to herself that when that time came, she would revisit her younger self and help guide others out of pain. J.J. is now the healthy and happy adult she once hoped she'd be, and her new book, Believorexic, is an attempt to fulfill that promise. It's a semi-autobiographical account of her hospitalization and the winding road to recovery. J.J. is going to read from her book at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh Sunday at 4, but first she is joining me in the studio. J.J. Johnson, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Tell us a bit about how you came to write this book.
Holy smokes, that's a tough act to follow. those fellows were doing amazing work. But we'll switch gears. I came to write the book because my editor and I were talking about me writing a trilogy. And she said, well, you know, you really need a faster book out there.
And we should say you write young adult fiction.
I do.
Right?
Okay. I do write young adult fiction. So I thought, oh, I have all these diaries and journals from my time in the hospital. That'll be really fast. It's all already there. This will be a really fast book to get out on paper. And I liked the idea not just of writing a new kind of problem novel, but writing a novel from the point of view of someone who had really lived through it and was committed to recovery.
It's interesting to me. You are writing young adult fiction, mm-hmm. and this is clearly a challenge that you faced as a young adult.
Mm-hmm.
Almost surprising it wasn't your first book.
Yes, I didn't want it to be my first book.
Is it something that you deliberately held back? Did it occur to you
so.
And think, oh, I'm not ready to write this yet?
No, it wasn't so much not being ready as I had other stories to tell. And, you know, people say you write your first book. Your first book is really 30 years in the making. And then I wanted to prove to myself that I could write books that weren't just about me. So.
This is an autobiographical novel mm-hmm. by your own lights. It's based on your diary. Tell us a bit about how you used your journal. Maybe you should tell us more about what you were going through and the challenges you faced as a young woman.
Okay. So I was 15 at the time. It was 1988 and in upstate New York. So the hospitalization takes place in a fictionalized version of a private psychiatric hospital in upstate New York in Syracuse. And what I was going through at the time was I knew I was sick. But I really didn't know how badly I was sick, and I knew I wanted help. But I was so good at hiding how sick I was with what I call bulimorexia, which is kind of a term that almost became a thing and almost got popular right in the late 1980s, but then the Psychology Association kind of backed off from that term. So it was a mixture of bulimia and anorexia. And I knew I was sick, but I didn't know how badly, and I was so good at covering it up that my parents didn't know. So I needed to tell them and say I need help.
Which is interesting. I want to stop you right mm-hmm. there. That does seem to defy at least the story we think we know
yes.
about eating disorders, mm-hmm. which is that denial is a very important part of this, and it takes mm-hmm. other people to bring you up. But you went the other way and said, look, I need help.
I did, yeah. So that is a difference in the book. And denial worked in some other ways. I really thought my family was absolutely okay, so I was in denial about other things. But I think also there are plenty of young people out there with eating disorders who know that something's wrong, but they might deny that they're bad enough to seek treatment. So I wanted to really say you're bad. If your eating disorder is interfering with your life, you're bad enough to get help.
And you did. And you chose to go into treatment. Tell us mm-hmm. what that was like then, the treatment.
It was locked doors. It was a private psychiatric hospital, like I said. And it used to be this old motel. So it was like these funky old rooms. And the unit was locked. We shared bedrooms with one other patient, and all the bathrooms were locked. So you had to, because of the nature of eating disorders, you had to keep your bathrooms locked. They had to be open doors were open about 5 inches, and the nurses had to flush your toilets for you until you kind of maintained or achieved mileposts in treatment, and then you could kind of earn your unsupervised bathroom.
Couldn't be a picky eater.
Couldn't be a picky eater, and I had been a terribly picky eater, so you had to eat everything on your tray, and it was just really hospital food, so it wasn't good.
Well, so those are the diaries, and that is your personal experience. As I say, you fictionalized those in your new novel, Believorexic, and I wonder if you can read a passage for us now.
Yeah, I would love to. So I'll read a couple of passages, and again, I call it a fictionalized novel, so the truth is kind of a straight line, is what I think of it as, and the novel kind of follows a wavy line over that straight line, so it intersects with the truth and veers away just to make a better story. So this is Jennifer's first night of treatment, her first night overnight, and there's been some commotion down the hall. So there are different units in the hospital, and someone has been screaming, and there are nurses running, and a code blue is called over the loudspeaker. Heather, her roommate, is still snoring. She slept through it all. How is that possible? Jennifer thinks of Kelly, who snores, but would never have slept through this, her best friend since kindergarten. When had their sleepovers started? That year? Or first grade? Whispers and giggles in the dark, bridging bed to sleeping bag. Back when Jennifer knew how to laugh, when happiness came easily. They still have sleepovers. They do all the things that best friends do, but it's been years since Jennifer felt like her laugh has been anything but false, hollow. When did it change? When did she stop being happy? She thinks back. Second grade, her worries got overwhelming. She cried every morning, certain her mother would die or an earthquake would split the world while she was at school. Third grade, fourth, fifth, the anxieties changed, but the distress was constant. Worry colonized one third of her brain, and she needed another third to fight it or appease it with routines and rituals while also appearing well-adjusted. It was exhausting, and over those years, sadness seeped into that last third of her mind. So slowly, it was hard to notice. Like the old story of how to cook a frog. If you throw a frog straight into boiling water, it will jump right out. But if you put it in cool water and turn up the heat slowly, the frog doesn't notice the change until it's too late.
J.J. Johnson reading from her book, Believorexic. She'll be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh Sunday at 4 o'clock with me today. Talk about that title, Believorexic. You coined the term.
Yes, I did. So it's based on that word we talked about, bulimorexia, which is the what most people have if they have eating disorders. They kind of are the eating disorders, quote, not otherwise specified. So they're usually not cut and dry one thing or another. But in writing the book and really in my life since having an eating disorder and recovering, I've come to believe that it's really about believing in yourself and in a better life, that there is a better life and a bigger world. And so it really was that process of coming to believe.
What you believe and how you believe is central to this. And I think it's one of the ways in which you shed light on this issue in ways that I had not thought about it before. Hmm. Belief structures. I'm going to ask you to read again in just a minute, and you're going to kind of demonstrate this for us. But ideology and idealism, ideals, are things that humans can do. Humans can take stuff that isn't real, hold it as an ideal, and it can animate their lives. The problem is, it's not real. And if that becomes your identity, we see what it does in politics. We see what people holding to ideologies have done to American politics.
Mm-hmm.
They can tear apart an entire party. They can tear apart two parties and leave you with almost nothing. This sort of evisceration of self, right, in the name of an ideal seems to be the point that you're getting at, that there's a real self here.
Mm-hmm.
There's hope for that self. But if you create this other thing, which may be created for you by images in the media, et cetera, it's going to fail. It's going to fail.
Amen, brother. I feel like you just...
I'll just
I feel like we might be done here.
It's the afterword
just summed it up.
To your book. Well, how much of that, and it does, I mean, those were, you have experienced this, and mm-hmm. this is what you, but not in the moment that you experienced the disorder. While you were having right. the disorder, none of those highfalutin thoughts came to you.
No.
When did those evolve?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because I did post my journal online. My actual journal is on believerexic.com, because I wanted to be very transparent about what was real and what wasn't, and I didn't want to feel disingenuous or like I was lying to anyone. But they're really boring at the beginning because I was so undernourished. And so understanding and kind of reintegrating all that psyche started to happen when two things happened. One was I became fed and healthier. And I really didn't realize what a huge difference that made. And the other thing is that I started to have relationships with people who got me and who understood who I was and where I was coming from. And that that's a hard thing to find sometimes when you're a young person and your options are limited.
Well, if you're surrounded by people who don't know who they are themselves,
right.
it's going to be hard for them to connect with that deep inner
Absolutely.
You
yeah.
that you think you are. Can I ask you to read this next passage?
Yes, I would Thanks. Love to. So the book goes on, and following that trajectory of reintegration, it changes into first person and then changes into first person present eventually. So not to be confused that it says I now. So Jennifer is in session with Dr. Prakash, who is her psychiatrist, and it's the late 80s, so she smokes, you'll notice. And she's starting to talk about whether Jennifer idealizes people. Dr. Prakash tapped her cigarette. If we idealize people, we also create a wide space between ideal and not ideal. I really want you to think about this because I believe you do this to yourself too. What? I definitely do not think I'm perfect. When we are perfectionists, we idealize ourselves. You are making yourself stand on the head of a pin. It is a grueling balancing act. You do not allow yourself to make any false moves, any mistakes. You have no freedom. You must earn top grades or you will fall off the pin. You must be liked by every single person or you will fall off the pin. You must maintain a low weight or you fall off the pin. Jennifer, it sounds quite exhausting. A sob shook loose from my chest. It is exhausting. I can't do it anymore. You do not have to do it anymore. What if I told you that you can set both your feet on solid ground and still be quite good at being you? How? By accepting that you are not perfect, nor should you be. You will be required to relax your standards a little bit. You will be required to give yourself a break. Do you understand what I am saying? I don't know. I guess so. What about me, Jennifer? Do you have me on the head of a pin right now? Will you push me off when I make a mistake? When I fall off, will we continue to be able to work together? Or will our time have been useless? It's not like that, I said. It's not all or nothing. Is it not? I hope you are right about that. She leaned forward. Jennifer, you must learn that recognizing people's flaws is a fine thing to do as long as you recognize their strengths as well. This mix of flaws and strengths, this is what makes us who we are. We cannot live our lives on the heads of pins. Sometimes we must aspire to be imperfect.
J.J. Johnson reading from Believerexic. She's going to be at Quail Ridge Books. Coming up very soon, Sunday at 4 o'clock, as a matter of fact. So this perfectionism is not just body type, but it mm-hmm. finds itself. And was that you? Were you
yeah.
having to get all A's and everything else?
Yeah, that was me. So all or nothing, really, yeah. thinking. So if I wasn't going to get an A, then I'd probably rather get an F. You know, there wasn't a lot of in between. And most of the family therapy and the therapy sessions and many of the conversations with nurses are almost verbatim.
You were careful yeah. in writing this book, in extracting from your diaries and not including in the book things that might be triggers for you and for mm-hmm. others who are experiencing eating disorders. Am I right?
That's right. I was very careful not to include specific weights because those can really be read by young people as goals to attain. I was very careful not to include specifics about how I binged or purged. None of that is in there. So I'm hearing from readers who really pick up on that. And it's very gratifying because they'll say that they can read this in the early stages of recovery and not be kind of triggered into going back into being sick.
And as you say, you've put your full diaries and journal online. And
yes.
In fact, you can link to those at our website, stateofthings.org.
Oh, I would love to do that.
So you can do that. Okay. You've read them, but others may want
Yeah.
check in on them. I have time for one more, and I really want to know now, knowing what you know, if you could go back in time and talk to your 15-year-old self, what would you tell yourself?
I would tell myself that you're on the right track and that things really do get better. And that the foundation that you're laying for knowing yourself is going to really serve you well in the future. And I would also tell myself to skip the Star Wars prequels because they weren't any good.
all of that.
Yeah.
That's all good advice for all of us, JJ.
Maybe buy Apple stock.
JJ, I don't know. Even now, maybe today I haven't looked. JJ Johnson, author of the new book, Believorexic. She's going to be reading at Quail Ridge Books Sunday, 4 o'clock. You can find out details about the book, about the journal, and about her readings at our website, stateofthings.org. And as I say, we're looking at the political mood of this state. So here's our question. As a North Carolinian, are you more or less politically engaged this year than in the past? You can find out how to answer that question if you go to our website, stateofthings.org. We'd love to hear from you and include your ideas on an upcoming program of The State of Things, produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.